My father came to TCD in 1930 from Enniscorthy, and as far as I know, he was always too shy to speak here. But he would go home and tell them all. He had two older brothers, and he would fill them with accounts of what he heard, and the wits and the things people said, and especially the interruptions that he heard in this room. And it's a funny experience that I haven't heard Adrian Hardiman speaking, I think, for 37 years, but certainly when I came up from Enniscorthy to UCD, and it was in Belfield and walking by Theatre M on a Friday night, and I was too shy to speak, but I went in every time and listened, and God, there were most extraordinary occasions. One night where Maura McEntee was speaking, and the heckling of her was something you wouldn't believe some of the things they shouted at her, and she shouted back at them. It was really an extraordinary evening. And I've never corrected or been allowed to add to Adrian before, either as his time as a judge or when he was in the Supreme Court. But one of the most interesting connections between James Joyce and the law is that Ulysses, the copy of Ulysses he had, was given to him by a man who was his friend, I think, well, Austin Clark, but perhaps I think he was the one who invented it. They called him the National Orphan. But he was otherwise known as Donough MacDonagh, who became a judge. He was Thomas MacDonagh's son, and he became a district judge. But anyway, that's another connection between here and the idea of Joyce. But anyway, here we go. There were three cities. Each of them had known a certain glory. In each of them, there was a sense that the glory was absent or ghostly, that the real world was elsewhere, that the cities in which there were many publishers and readers, for example, or pure excitement or cultural completeness, they were elsewhere. All three cities had remained mainly untouched by the Second World War. They had not been bombed, for example, as the war proceeded, nor had they been transformed by reconstruction when the war ended. Even into the 1980s and 1990s, it was possible to walk around many parts of these cities and notice that nothing much had changed for many, many decades. These were three capital cities in which politics and culture could be best treated as a joke, or a game between dull factions in which one faction would remain dominant in a dormant or indecent or a brutal sort of way for many years. There were difficult cities for young men with literary ambitions. There were places in which both the present and the future seemed like 100 years of solitude. These three cities in which three geniuses felt trapped, isolated and dismayed, made their way slowly, inevitably, into the very core, the very essence of the work of these three writers. The cities both disabled them and gave them an immense imaginative power, poisoned them and nourished them, made their spirits playful, but made two of them lock away some of their best work, allow it to gather dust rather than seek readers. The sense that there was no one much to read the work these writers were producing ate its way into the tone and structure of the work itself. Their books did not come from the world, their books became the world. In the beginning was the word, but there was often nothing except the word and its hollow echoes, and this gave their playful spirit an edge that was often melancholy, often manic. The fact that these cities were the capital cities of countries ostensibly Catholic did nothing to help. Yet out of the very emptiness, out of the non-sacramental, at the heart of where they were, these writers still found words and literary forms, old ones and hybrid ones, fascinating. Some dream impelled them towards work, towards producing work which would eventually make them famous. The idea for them of what lay between the old and the hybrid, however, was a problem. A great tradition in fiction in which characters had choices and chances and possessions and destinies to fulfill was for them a great joke. A locomotive in a siding whose engine was all rust. They began by dismantling the escape routes and then the wheels. For them, the very notion of character itself and even identity was to be undermined or driven over. Then they set out to undermine not only choice and chance and destiny, but the idea of time and indeed space, infinity and eternity, would fascinate them, and the idea of form. It was not an accident that these three men had no children, that they did not write about women or in the case of two of them, that they indulged in a rare to medium rare misogyny. When two of them married, it came as a great surprise to their friends that they seemed more at home and more happily desperate as uneasy bachelors than fathers or husbands. The cities in which they lived were Lisbon, Buenos Aires, and Dublin. The writers were Fernando Pessoa, born 1888, died 1935. Jorge Luis Borges, born 1899, died 1986. Flann O'Brien, born 100 years ago today, died 1966. Each of them was brought up not only in a shadow country and city, or a place that felt as though it lived now in the shade, but each of them was brought up also with two or more languages, and with often a disruptive relationship between the languages. The idea of a mother tongue for them was a sort of joke. All three of them were for a time educated at home or in libraries, away from the company of other boys and the influence of teachers. They made up their own world. Pessoa lived in Durban in South Africa between the ages of 8 and 17, and returned to Lisbon speaking English better than Portuguese. He wrote poems in English. Borges had an English grandmother who lived with the family and was brought up speaking English and Spanish. He lived in Geneva between the ages of 15 and 22, speaking English, French, and Spanish. Flann O'Brien spoke only Irish until the age of 9 or 10, when he began to speak English as well. Each of these writers made up names for themselves. Pessoa became, among others, Ricardo Reis, Alberto Queiro, Álvaro de Campos, Bernardo Suárez. Borges became, among other names, B. Suárez Lynch and H. Bustos Domecq. All three of them at various times worked out strategies to present a fresh persona to the world, as well as fiction in which they invented further personae and indeed further worlds. Borges was acutely conscious that the world that he and Flann O'Brien came from, the narrow, isolated and hybrid culture which gave rise to them, in which they struggled, was both restricting and liberating. In a lecture from 1951 called The Argentine Writer in Tradition, Borges wrote about the energy and sense of innovation which came from the margins. He believed, he wrote, that the Argentine tradition, quote, is the whole of Western culture. And I also believe we have a right to this tradition, a greater right than that which the inhabitants of one Western nation or another may have. He went on in his lecture to ponder the position of Irish writers in this context. Where the Irish are concerned, we have no reason to suppose that the profusion of Irish names in British literature and philosophy is due to any social preeminence, because many of these illustrious Irishmen, Shaw, Berkeley, Swift, were the descendants of Englishmen, men with no Celtic blood. Nevertheless, the fact of feeling themselves to be Irish, to be different, was enough to make them make innovations in English culture. I believe that the Argentines and South Americans in general are in an analogous situation. We can take on all the European subjects, take them on without superstition and with an irreverence that can have and already has had fortunate consequences. Fernando Pessoa, in his The Art of Translation, took the view that the history of plagiarisms would be a possible masterpiece and would brim over with literary lessons. He also believed, he wrote, or maybe he just wrote, there is actually no need to suggest that he inferred belief from what he wrote, that there can be no doubt that many poems, even many great poems, would gain by being translated into the very language they were written in. In his Pierre Ménard, author of Don Quixote, Borges played with the idea that Pierre Ménard's text of the 9th and 38th and a fragment of chapter 22 of Don Quixote, even though word for word and line for line the same, was more subtle than the original and infinitely richer. Just as novelists in the 19th century had made a fetish of the world, of things or words like love or destiny or marriage or money, Borges, Pessoa and O'Brien made a fetish of the book. In Pessoa's The Book of Disquiet, our hero muses, "Why should I care that no one reads what I write? I write to forget about life, and I publish because that's one of the rules of the game. If tomorrow all my writings were lost, I'd be sorry, but I doubt I'd be violently and frantically sorry." Later, he wrote, "Perhaps the novel is a more perfect life and reality, which God creates through us. Perhaps we live only to create it." Later, he referred to life as a plotless novel. in Borges's The Library of Babel begins the universe which others call the library. The business of the book as an object which contains the world and which therefore does not require readers, since it also contains its readers, since they are merely part of the world, settles ironically, mysteriously, and sometimes savagely around Flann O'Brien. Mysteriously because of the 244 copies which were sold of A Swim Two Birds before the warehouse in England where the books were kept was bombed. One of them made their way to Argentina. This was 1939. Ireland, Portugal, and Argentina were about to become even more marginalized by remaining effectively outside the Second World War. Dublin, Lisbon, and Buenos Aires were about to become even more strange than before. Yet just more than 2 months after its publication, Borges in Buenos Aires reviewed At Swim Two Birds in Spanish in the magazine El Hogar. He wrote, a student in Dublin writes a novel about the habitués of his pub, among them the student, who in turn write novels in which proprietor and student figure along with other writers of novels about other novelists. The book consists of the extremely diverse manuscripts of these real or imagined persons, copiously annotated by the student. A Swim Two Birds is not only a labyrinth, it is a discussion of the many ways to conceive of the Irish novel and a repertory of exercises in prose and verse which illustrate or parody all the styles of Ireland. The magisterial influence of Joyce, also an architect of labyrinths, also a literary Proteus, is undeniable, but not disproportionate in this manifold book. Thus, one copy of the book lived in Buenos Aires, and maybe another, because strangely, a friend of Borges and Bioy Casares, who worked alongside Borges, called Juan Rodolfo Wilcock, who moved his literary enterprise as a poet novel. He was fighting with Perón, or at least he had difficulty with him, so he decided to move his enterprise as a poet, novelist, and translator from Spanish to Italian. In other words, he moved from Argentina and not only stopped writing in Spanish, but not only stopped living in a Spanish-speaking language, but moved in to become a translator into Italian. And he moved there in 1951, and he subsequently did the Italian translation of At Swim Two Birds. Dreaming and wakefulness are pages of a single book, Borges quotes Schopenhauer in his review of A Swim Two Birds. For these three writers, O'Brien, Borges and Pessoa, the business of dreaming was as essential and nourishing to fiction as the business of being, or the even busier business of not being much. In A Swim Two Birds, the character Byrne announces, we should not sleep to recover the energy expended when awake, but rather wake occasionally to defecate the unwanted energy that sleep engenders. An interest in sleep and dreams is partly why Shakespeare haunts Borges and Pessoa. Shakespeare was their contemporary in that he allowed dreaming into the body of his work. Flann O'Brien saw the comic possibilities in the idea, such as it is, that the dreams we have offer a sort of hidden narrative of the self. Borges said that he believed that psychoanalysis was merely a dark side of science fiction. Thus, it is only when Trellis dreams that the world he has made comes into being. For the rest of the time, he's merely a dull novelist trying to exert control. His characters only come alive, as we know, when he lies asleep. In one of Borges's best stories, A Circular Ruins, the protagonist, the man who no one saw disembark in the unanimous night. No one has ever understood why Borges wrote the word unanimous. It's the same word in Spanish. It looks like a mistranslation. It's just a word obviously thought of and wrote down, unanimous night. It has never been, as we know, as I know of anyway, maybe, correct me, a unanimous night. Knew that his immediate obligation was to sleep. The purpose which guided him was not impossible, though it was supernatural. He wanted to dream a man. He wanted to dream him with minute integrity and insert him into reality. When the moon was full and he had purified himself in the waters of the river, worshipped the planetary gods, uttered the lawful syllables of a powerful name and slept, then almost immediately he dreamt of a beating heart. He dreamt it as active, warm, secret, the size of a closed fist, of garnet colour in the penumbra of the human body, as yet without face or sex. With minute love, he dreamt it for 14 lucid nights. In the conversations which Borges had with Bioy Casares, they were published a number of years ago in a sort of huge volume, there are many references to dreams, including one in 1978, in which Beppo, Borges's cat, told him that he would not live long, or in 1974, when he sang to Bioy two lines he had known in childhood, which translate as, "Last night I dreamt that a pure angel came from heaven and bit me on the bottom." On the 21st of October 1979, when Borges was 80, he had dreamed that a strong dwarf put feathers, which became birds, into his mouth. And then he had a dream of books. He dreamed he told Bioy that he was in a library where there were infinite numbers of identical books. They were all bound. They had no titles, no any name or authors on them. They were like books of thoughts or short fragments. I read some of the sentences. They were incomprehensible. I wanted to leave, but I couldn't find the exit. There was a man in the library, and he was a friend of mine, and I asked him where the exit was. "There isn't one," he said. Borges went on to remark that both Dr. Johnson and Schopenhauer had noted that in a dream, often a secondary character knows something that the main character, the dreamer, does not. These ideas would have fascinated Tversky and his friends in A Swim, Two Birds, who were sure that they knew what Trellis did not, even though Trellis was their dreamer. This idea of a dreamer finding no escape in a library made of fragments would have also interested Pessoa. In his first piece of fiction, the narrator was half awake and half asleep. In 1914, he wrote to a friend about his book of disquiet. "It's all fragments, fragments, fragments." One of his inventions, his heteronym Vicente Guedes, in a story wrote, "If you dream you're dreaming, is the dream you dream less real than the dream you dream you're dreaming?" In the book of disquiet, the narrator writes, "I realize that I was all error and deviation, that I never lived, and that I existed only insofar as I filled time with consciousness and thought. I feel in this moment like a man who wakes up after a slumber full of real dreams." Later, he muses further on dreams. All life is a dream. No one knows what he's doing. No one knows what he wants. No one knows what he knows. We sleep our lives, eternal children of destiny. And later again, this is Pessoa, "The dreamer's superiority is due to the fact that dreaming is much more practical than living, and the dreamer gets far greater and more varied pleasure out of life than the man of action. In other and plainer words, the dreamer is the true man of action." And later, he accepts the world begrudgingly, just about each life, that of dreams and that of the world, has a reality all of its own that's just as valid as the other, but different. Like things near versus things far away. "The figure of dreams are nearer to me, but," he does not say, "but what?" "Why should I care that no one reads what I write?" Pessoa wrote. Later, he who did not publish most of his best work during his own life began to muse on what this meant. "The pleasure of future fame," he wrote, "is a present pleasure. The fame is what's future. It may be illusory, but it is in any case far greater than the pleasure of enjoying only what's here." Later, in one of his greatest passages, he wondered what posterity had ever done for him, and thus began to feel, as we all do, nostalgia for the future. This is Pessoa. "It sometimes occurs to me with sad delight that if one day in a future to which I won't belong, the sentences I write are read and admired, then at last I'll have my own kin, people who understand me, my true family in which to be born and loved. But far from being born into it, I'll have already died long ago. I'll be understood only in effigy, when affection can no longer compensate for the indifference that was the dead man's lot in life. Perhaps one day they'll understand that I fulfilled, like no one else, my instinctive duty to interpret a portion of our century. And that when they've understood that, they'll write that in my time I was misunderstood, that the people around me were unfortunately indifferent and insensitive to my work, and that it was a pity this happened to me. And whoever writes this will fail to understand my literary counterpart in that future time, just as my contemporaries don't understand me, because men learn only what would be of use to their great-grandparents. The right way to live is something we can teach only the dead."
Pessoa was filled with suspicion of publishing and by the fame it might bring. The only noble destiny for a writer who publishes is to be denied a celebrity he deserves. But the truly noble destiny belongs to the writer who doesn't publish. To publish the socialization of oneself, a vile necessity. Borges and Bioy, as we can imagine, had much to say about fame and infamy and publishing. On 10th of December 1968, Borges quoted Melville's disapproval of fame with approval. But Bioy was not so sure. Melville was right, he said, but, he added, in too much darkness or obscurity live monsters filled with conceited bitterness. Borges's first book, A Universal History of Infamy, published in April 1936, had by the end of 1936 sold 37 copies, thus competing seriously with That Swim Two Birds' 244 copies in 18 months. On the 1st of May 1958, Bioy said to Borges that he believed there was something good about publishing rather than not. It was a way, he said, of losing vanity. Borges and Bioy took pleasure in this loss of vanity. Their obscurity filled them with glee, especially once it had come to an end. A year before he died, I had lunch with Bioy in a restaurant close to the Recoleta Cemetery in Buenos Aires. Bioy discovered that I had paid money for back issues of the magazine Sur, where much of his fiction and that of Borges had first been published. He was amused. No one, he said, has ever paid money for that magazine before. Did none of those magazines ever sell, I asked. Oh, yes, he replied, once. We published a literary magazine, Borges and I, he said, and sold it ourselves outside the Polo Ground one day. Luckily, it was raining, and it was just the right size to protect the seat of your pants from the wet seat. Thus, many people bought it. That, he said, was our great success. He knew, I hoped, that I did not believe that he or Borges had ever stood outside Polo Grounds on good days or bad, but he had made his point. In his book, A Colder Eye, Hugh Kenner asked, how did Flann O'Brien dare to try, quote, to suppress his own great book, The Third Policeman? This book, as we know, was written quickly after At Swim Two Birds. It was turned down by publishers in 1940 and did not appear in print until 1967, a year after its author's death. For a book that turns out to be about a dead man, Kenner wrote, that has an eerie rightness. It's possible to guess, Kenner goes on, that he was somehow scared of it. O'Brien kept the typescript close by him and mined parts of it for his novel The Dorky Archive, which he published in 1964. Even when he needed money and his wife pointed out to him that he had in his possession an unsold novel, he did not let anyone see the book between 1940 and his death. He got on with brilliant hackwork and manic drinking. He may indeed, as Hugh Kenner says, especially before 1960, when he had a new relationship, by which time in 1960, the new relationship with a London publisher had been scared of the rejected book and saw no reason why he should wait for it to be rejected once more, as it probably would have been. But there are other more interesting reasons for keeping the book on a sideboard or in a drawer, gathering dust, its contents known only to the author, who was slowly moving towards death. I remember that last house he lived in, which I visited in the early 1980s, the modern bungalow in the deep Dublin suburbs, how pretty and neat it all was, almost like a toy house. Anthony Cronin writes of Flann O'Brien's last years in Walter's Land Road. He had appropriated the best room in the house, one which was bright and sunny and had French doors into the garden. Into this he moved the double bed which had belonged to his mother and father, and here he spent a great deal of time, sometimes writing in bed, always, except in warmest weather, with the electric fire on. Rather than being scared by the proximity of his manuscript, The Third Policeman, as he lay like Dermot Trellis in bed, the idea for O'Brien that the characters from his novel, The Third Policeman, had moved a step further towards pure autonomy than the characters from At Swim Two Birds must have given him some satisfaction as an artist. It is possible that the book did not, in these moments, worry him, as Kenner suggested, or scare him, but instead filled him with the same satisfaction as silence filled Beckett or John Cage, or ideas of eternity or infinity filled Borges, or ideas of monotony and weariness filled Pessoa. O'Brien's characters, as long as he lived, had their own life in black marks on the pages of the book. Day and night they lived there, with only each other for company, redemption coming only when their creator passed into his final sleep, which he did on April Fool's Day, 1966. Thank you.